Just before you start listening to this podcast, a reminder that we have a special subscription offer. You can get 12 issues of The Spectator for £12, as well as a £20 Amazon voucher. Go to spectator.co.uk/voucher if you'd like to get this offer.
Hello and welcome to Coffee House Shots, The Spectator's daily and these days more than daily politics podcast. I'm Katie Balls and I'm joined by James Forsyth, and we're recording from a slightly remote location in Norwich. Now, the big news today relates to an intervention from the chief rabbi warning against a Labour government given their position on anti-Semitism. James, what exactly does he say?
It's an extraordinary intervention from the chief rabbi. The chief rabbis are normally very averse at getting involved in anything that could be called party political. But in a piece in the Times today, the chief rabbi says there's nothing more at stake here in this election than the kind of conscience of a nation. He essentially runs through Jeremy Corbyn's associations with people with anti-Semitic views and says, you know, how much would you have to do to not be fit to be prime minister? And it's quite clear what he thinks the answer to that question is. And I think today we had Labour's launch of Labour's kind of race and faith manifesto. And I think in some ways you saw the problem there, that some of the people on the stage were people who had said things that I think most people would consider to be extremely dubious, if not outright anti-Semitic, comments about kind of Zionist masters and things like that. And I think that is the problem, which is that Jeremy Corbyn seems to have a kind of willful blindness on this question. He doesn't seem to understand what the problem is. And if you don't understand what the problem is, you can't deal with it.
And when it comes to how Labour have responded to the criticism, so have had ultimately, from their perspective, a reassertion that Jeremy Corbyn takes all forms of racism seriously, that he has done his best to tackle anti-Semitism in the past. James, how much of an election issue do you think this is? Because if we're being completely honest, we've been hearing about Labour and anti-Semitism for quite a long time now, since before the 2017 snap election, and that didn't seem to dent Labour's chances too much there. I mean, clearly they didn't win, but they did do a lot better than anyone expected. So do you think this is actually going to make people think twice about voting, I suppose, outside areas which have high Jewish populations?
I think one of the things to appreciate is, but you know, there are oddballs with these kind of abhorrent views in all political parties. You know, the Tories about to get rid of a candidate or two who've said very dodgy things on this question.
Yeah, and being quick to flip it today to say, actually, the Tories have an Islamophobia problem as well.
But I think what is different about Labour and why it is being investigated by the Equalities and Human Rights Commission is that it almost does seem to be kind of institutionalised. It's not that there are some oddballs who get slung out on their ear as soon as it's found. But, you know, in certain cases, the leader's office seem to have a certain and sympathy with some of the people involved. Yeah, we saw that on the question time when a member of the audience confronted Jeremy Corbyn, saying, look, you know, when Ruth Smith, a female Jewish MP, was very badly heckled at a Labour event, Jeremy Corbyn spoke to the person who had been heckling her afterwards, and not purely in a kind of finger-wagging way, in a kind of, you know, conversational way. And I think this is the issue. I think this is the problem, which is Jeremy Corbyn has operated in a world which is so anti-imperialistic that it has allowed its hostility to the West and to the State of Israel to bleed into something else much less pleasant.
And it has, at the very least, that meant that on a day when Jeremy Corbyn was hoping to launch his party's plan to increase diversity, to talk about their review into colonialism and Britain's past, meant their attention has been firmly away from that and on problems the party has on similar issues. And you had a situation where Jeremy Corbyn was rather late to the launch day, and some took that as a sign he's going through it. Difficult timing. Of course, it could be something else, but it does mean that I think where Labour want to be on the front foot, they're clearly on the back foot when it comes to the news agenda.
Yeah, and also I think that the thing I would just keep emphasising to people is, this is a quite extraordinary intervention from the chief rabbi. The chief rabbi is not a figure who courts controversy, and so I think for that reason it is particularly telling.
Now, elsewhere, we've had Sajid Javid giving a speech, the Chancellor who we expect to still be Chancellor after the election if the Tories win a majority, given that Boris Johnson has made that promise. Now, he had a warning about Labour and, you guessed it, high spending and what that would cost the average voter. James, Labour have been very keen to say only the top 5% will pay for any of their spending plans. They're very keen to, even when you go into it, refine the top 5% to billionaires where they can, to try and not put off, I suppose, 80k and over earners. What was Sajid Javid's message?
Sajid Javid's message is essentially the same as the IFS's message. It's just not credible to say that you can fund an extra amount of spending equivalent to another NHS every year just by taxing the top 5% and big businesses more. And, you know, I do think this is, I think when you look at the sheer size of Labour spending commitments, it is very hard to imagine that you could achieve that in a sustainable way without a broader based increase on taxes on everyone earning over, certainly over, the average wage. And yet, if you look at the kind of countries where Labour wants to increase levels of public spending to equivalent to, they have broadly higher tax rates on middle earners than the UK does.
Now, have you got any sense yet when it comes to Labour's various offers, how they're landing on the doorstep? Because the big one on Sunday was the WASPI woman, an issue lots of people feel very passionate about. And if you take it, I suppose, as one of several pledges from Labour, it's quite easy to start to say, where is the money coming from, and make this argument. But it also, you can see how this could have some cut through in lots of areas on the doorstep. So, James, are you picking up anything from Tory MPs on this?
Well, I had a kind of slightly concerned call from a Tory MP last night. And the conventional wisdom has been that there are so many Labour spending commitments now that they're becoming almost unmemorable. But this person's worry was the opposite. He said he worried that the WASPI women thing is huge. I mean, they're talking about, it's not in the manifesto costings document, and they're talking about finding, I think it's, is it £58 billion? And, you know, now they're saying they're going to fund that by extra borrowing, but for the state to fund, to borrow an extra £58 billion on top of all the other extra borrowing it wants to do under Labour, you know, at some point the markets are going to begin to raise an eyebrow. Now,
if they think it's a credible threat of Jeremy Corbyn going into government.
And so I think so what this experienced Tory MP's concern was that the media have almost stopped kind of dissecting all these Labour spending commitments because there are just so many of them. We almost can't keep up. But what is happening is that the people who would benefit from them are hearing it. And this person had been out on the doorstep yesterday, and, you know, quite a few of these WASPI women had been working out how much they were going to get on this plan. And this person's worry was that while the Labour offer in the round might seem incredible, some of this has been narrow cast very effectively. And I suspect if we don't see, well, we'll talk about this more in a second, if we don't see more tightening in the polls, I think we might see more offers from Labour like this. Big offers targeted at a very specific group, hoping to basically say to people, look, you go out and vote because you will get this if you vote Labour. And while as the overall fiscal envelope might not be credible, people might be prepared to believe that they are going to get their bit of it, they're going to get.
Now, finally, on the subject of leads and poll leads, let's talk about a poll that came out last night, which actually puts the gap between the Tories and Labour at just 7 points, which is much closer, I suppose, and in theory would give the Tories cause for comfort. And if there's only a 7-point lead for the Conservatives, the prospect of a majority isn't quite so clear cut. It depends a lot on where it falls.
Yeah, I mean, it's right on the cusp. Some poll watchers would tell you the Tories need to be 6 points ahead for a majority, others eight. So that tells you how close a 7-point lead is. And I think the Tories were expecting their lead to go down a bit this week, and that they think they've basically squeezed all the juice there is out of the Brexit Party. Labour have some more left to squeeze out of the Liberal Democrats. But, you know, because of what happened last time, I mean, there'll be Tory worries that, you know, this is another, you know, Labour are just going to move up and up as the in the closing weeks of a campaign. But I think on the other hand, they won't be too unhappy to see some tightening, because I think if you talk to, you know, in private, one of their worries was a growing sense that the Tories were going to win and that you didn't have to vote for them for Jeremy Corbyn not to be Prime Minister. And, you know, one of the things that really hurt them in 2017 was the feeling that the choice on election day was between a large Tory majority and a small one. And most voters preferred a small one, so they were happy to kind of vote against the Tories because no one was really taking the prospect of Labour and government particularly seriously. But, I mean, I think if we see more tightening, and especially from those pollsters such as YouGov, that have traditionally been showing slightly healthier Tory leads than ICM, then I think there will be a bit more nerves.
And perhaps then we might see a slightly less risk-averse campaign, because one of the things I've noticed is clearly it's very repetitive, and I think those in CCHQ think that repetitive is good. We keep hearing get Brexit done, the message lands. But I do get the sense that were Boris Johnson to no longer look at as such an assured front runner, they might have to start to take some risks.
Yeah, at the moment, this is a Tory campaign that wants to, in the final weeks of a campaign, go back to its kind of classic messages. Do you want to get Brexit done, or do you want two referendums in 2020? Do you want a Tory majority or a hung parliament of Labour propped up by the SNP? I thought it was very, you know, one of the things that the Tories think are hoping to get out of Boris Johnson's visit to Scotland earlier today is not only to kind of boost their standing in Scotland and their manifesto up there is just entitled No to Indie Ref 2, very different from Get Brexit Done. But also, I think they want to kind of emphasise this point of if there's a hung parliament, the SNP are going to hold the balance of power, because what they are essentially trying to do is to reprise the 2015 campaign rather than the 2017 campaign. And I think the question becomes, you know, can they do that? But are they going to feel obliged to take some more risks?
Thank you, James, and thank you for listening. And we'll be back tomorrow from hopefully a slightly quieter room. So do bear with us for that.